From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Every city and town in America has a road or a bridge that needs fixing. And that's why President Biden is trying to drum up support for his $2 trillion infrastructure plan. He's pitching the proposal again today. So why don't we check in with one of America's big city mayors? Democrat Greg Fisher runs Louisville, Kentucky. He's also president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mayor, welcome. President Biden calling for hundreds of billions of dollars for roads, bridges, broadband. What do you see that would help your city?
Many things in the bill would help our city. Broadband, high-speed broadband, is not ubiquitous yet in our city. That's a project that we're in the middle of. So obviously we need help with the basic, what we call old-fashioned infrastructure in terms of roads and sidewalks and bridges. We're in the middle of implementing a consent decree on wastewater, as most cities are in the eastern United States as well. So we have tremendous needs that we've just been band-aiding together in the cities of America for way too long. It's what we need to pull out of this economic recession that was caused by the pandemic.
There's $80 billion earmarked for Amtrak in this plan, and Amtrak has said that it would use that money to fund a new route connecting Louisville to Chicago. I don't think your city has had a rail service in decades like that or ever. Do you think people would use it? How would that change things for you?
Yeah, it's been about over 20 years or so, and I think what you're seeing in the jobs plan, American jobs plan, is kind of a reimagining of America. So more rail is part of that, whether it's in the middle part of the country like Louisville and Chicago or along the eastern seaboard, so we can have a competitive rail system that moves people and freight around in a way that is better than our foreign adversaries. And we haven't had this kind of opportunity to invest in the infrastructure of our country for 60 or 70 years. It's way past due, and it's much needed in this rapidly changing economic order that we have right now.
But as you know, a bill of this size, it's not going to come without controversy. President Biden wants to raise the corporate tax rate to help pay for it, and Republicans say there's just too much in there that's not actually infrastructure or traditional infrastructure. They point to a $400 billion provision that would expand home care services, nearly $600 billion for domestic manufacturing, research, job training, that sort of thing. Do you think this bill is too big, and should it be pared back so that you can get some Republicans on board?
It's always better when there's bipartisan political support, but clearly there's bipartisan support amongst the American people who support it at a 70% clip. But you point out the issues like R&D investment. Some of the greatest advances in America have been because of federally funded research and development. I am an entrepreneur and business person that just happens to be mayor right now. And when I think about the scale of investment that's needed to reposition our national economy, that can only be done at the national level. So there's a lot there. And I say, when people are talking about increasing the corporate tax, Peter, I'd say restore the corporate tax to what it was. This is a problem in America. You know, Americans want everything, but they don't want to pay for anything. And it just doesn't work that way.
It sounds to me like you're saying, yes, you do want to get some Republicans on board with this, but no, it should not be pared back. It needs to be this ambitious. How can you have both?
Well, that's where the sausage making is going to come into play. Certainly, it would be better if there was Republican support. As I said, there's a lot of Republican support in the citizens of America. So that's the whole purpose of a bill. You put it out there, you start talking about it. Maybe there's some things that are not in the bill that should go in there. Maybe there's some things that should come out of it. This is what America wants to see, okay? Mayors, I said, are in the reality business. We're kind of the essential workers of the political order of getting things done in day in and day out. And I can tell you, people look at Washington and see this squabbling going on and just say, can you guys come like to the adult table and get something done here? Because we need to be moving forward as a country and coming out of this recession that was caused by the pandemic and doing it in a different way, doing it in a more equitable and innovative way.
Well, you know, there are some Republican mayors who do support this. Here's Fort Worth, Texas Mayor Betsy Price. She's speaking to The Washington Post.
It's been a long time since the feds put major money into our highways, our infrastructure. I think more money that goes into that and into infrastructure of any type, plus it creates jobs, is going to be a winning message for many people.
So when you put on your hat as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, I'm sure you speak with some Republicans who are running cities across this country who do support this bill. How common is that?
I don't know any Republican mayors that are not supporting the bill. Because we live with the needs of our citizens and the economy each and every day. So when you take a look at the shape of our roads and bridges, lack of broadband, in some cities lack of clean water and wastewater. I mean, these are not only basics that we've got to take care of, but they're issues that we've got to do to compete more in the future. So local folks and mayors are just tired of it because we got to get things done.
Greg Fisher is the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, and president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. He's a Democrat. Mr. Fisher, thank you so much.
Okay, Peter. Take care.
So what's going on in Michigan, now the country's top hotspot for COVID-19? On Monday, that state joined others in lowering the age to get a vaccination in Michigan. They're now available 16 and up. But as COVID-19 cases have been rising nationally for 4 weeks in a row, data shows a 105% increase in Michigan in the last 2 weeks and a staggering 133% rise in kids aged 10 to 19 in the last month. Now, health officials point to pandemic fatigue as well as the more contagious B.1.1.7 variant, but also to kids' sports. Kids are thankfully mostly getting just mild cases, but they are spreading it to adults, parents, and coaches. Today, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky again urged that communities seeing spikes limit indoor youth sports. Dr. Lawrence Reynolds is a retired pediatrician and a member of Governor Gretchen Whitmer's Protect Michigan Commission. They work on getting vaccines out, and now they're racing ahead of these case spikes. Doctor, what's your opinion on kids' sports in Michigan?
I'll state a position that's not very popular, and that is we should do what is necessary and essential. Yes, there are benefits from athletics, but it is not essential. And we have children traveling on buses from school district to school district, from county to county. And so they can become infected in their travels. Yes, we are testing every day before a competition. Yes, there are guidelines. But my position is this is an unnecessary risk, despite the demonstrations in Lansing insisting that school sports open up. And it's painful to see the work that we started back in November just falling apart. I mean, when you threaten to burn our governor, our secretary of state, and our attorney general at the state and refer to them as witches, that's tantamount to saying, and we should lynch the black officials too. There is a mood in Michigan. It's mind-boggling.
You're talking about the head of the Republican Party in the state who said that people like Governor Whitmer should be burned at the stake. And that is part of the problem, is that there are people protesting that sports are not the problem, but it's turning out with kids that they are. We're seeing stories across the country of youth athletic coaches who have died. But also there are moves we know in Michigan to try to stem that, including testing. Talk about the impact of testing.
Well, it's really too soon to assess the impact of testing. It's a good way of monitoring what's going on in the community, of what's going on in the school, of what's going on in the team. But sometimes if you test too early, that test doesn't give you an accurate reading. So, yes, we have to continually test, but then we have to look at the community spread. And in our county, it's 17% positive testing. We are at the highest level of number of new cases. And yes, most of them are in adults, but it does beg the question, how many are transmitted by asymptomatic children and younger people?
Yeah. Kids 13 to 19 in Michigan are mandated to be tested before all practices and competitions. This is an order from the governor. Minnesota recommends all school-age kids going back to school and their families get tested every 2 weeks, just so that you can immediately remove the people who are infected from that population. But still, talk about the unique aspect of sports. This is kids' sports. It's not like the NCAA. So you're not banning families and grandparents from the sidelines. There are a lot of people who come to see these games. Even if they're masked, we're seeing whole families getting sick.
Yes, and our Republican-dominated legislature passed a law saying that the governor could not limit the number of families because they wanted equal access for all families despite their size. There are restrictions on how, or guidance on how, there should be seating in an outdoor stadium. But how can you eat or drink with a mask on? So that presents its challenges. And what do people typically do at games? They're shouting. But is this the correct time to add an additional risk? And I say no.
Well, you can also add to that, you know, carpooling, people sleep over each other's houses, they have team celebrations. Are you saying, you know, you would, as a pediatrician, say stop all of that for at least a while?
Oh, yes, especially while we are at this peak. Why school athletics has to be a special subclass in this discussion, I don't think it's a good approach.
That's Dr. Lawrence Reynolds, a retired pediatrician. He also is on the state's commission to try to increase vaccine education and access while they scramble to stay ahead of a new rise in COVID-19 cases. Dr. Reynolds, thank you.
Thank you.
President Biden is warning that the fight against the coronavirus is far from over.
The virus is spreading because we have too many people who, seeing the end in sight, think we're at the finish line already. But let me be deadly earnest with you. We aren't at the finish line. We still have a lot of work to do.
In contrast, Biden is at the starting line for getting his massive $2 trillion infrastructure bill passed, and he may just have gotten a jump start. So let's bring in our political strategist. Bill Press is the Democrat. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
And Alice Stewart, the Republican. Alice, hello to you as well.
Hi, Robin. Great to be with you.
And let's get right to it. Biden's infrastructure bill got a boost this week when the Senate parliamentarian ruled that Senate Democrats can pass it with a simple majority, meaning all they have to do is, you know, hold on to Democrats to pass it. They don't need to go through the process of getting a supermajority, bringing over Republicans. Republicans say the bill is stuffed with things that aren't about infrastructure. So, Bill, to you first, is this cheating? You know, Democrats now don't have to compromise or be bipartisan.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's cheating. It is legal. The parliamentarian wouldn't have said it otherwise. But I have to tell you, I don't think it's the best way to go. I really think it's the unnecessary way to go. I have a better alternative, Robin. Let's start with this. Our infrastructure is way, way, way overdue for being brought up to the 21st century. Barack Obama talked about it, didn't do anything. Donald Trump talked about it, didn't do anything. Now it's Joe Biden's turn. I think he's serious. And so he's put forth this plan. There are only two problems with this, or questions raised, I guess. One, what's in it, and how do you pay for it? Now, you know what? Both of those things are negotiable if people would only sit down and get to work. So my alternative is, let's make a deal. Republicans don't think this ought to be in there. Let's go see if they can get enough votes to stop it. Then you take that out. Same thing, pay for it. You want to go for taxes? You don't like that? Then let's just borrow the money. If they don't like that, then maybe some combination. What's lacking is the ability and the willingness of Republicans to deal. Mitch McConnell has said no, 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 provided no alternatives. And sadly, every Republican senator has gone along with him.
Alice, I'm going to go right to you because I'm imagining you're probably disagreeing with that take on it. Well, and we know that there's a wary Democrat or two. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin doesn't like the corporate tax hikes that are in this bill, but those hikes don't even come close to what corporations were being asked to pitch in before President Trump slashed them. And Alice, polls show people want this bill. So first of all, do you agree that it's Republicans who are not, you know, not willing to compromise? And shouldn't they compromise if polls show overwhelmingly people can see with their own eyes their roads and bridges are in rough shape?
Well, I can say that, yes, people see that roads and bridges need to be repaired because they do. But this bill includes far more funding for issues that aren't directly related to roads and bridges. And I will go on record as saying that I agree with a portion of what Bill did say. This is not the way Democrats should go about doing this. Look, the Senate parliamentarian is nonpartisan, and he can certainly make this ruling. It was a tremendous shot in the arm for Democrats. But if they are banking on getting their policies through by just getting a 50-50 split in the Senate with only Democrat support, that flies in the face of everything that Joe Biden campaigned on and won on by saying he's going to work across the aisle. And the key here is when you have a spending plan this massive in nature with just calling it infrastructure and you have $400 billion for unrelated programs. You have $174 billion to subsidize electric vehicle industry. And you also have other policies and funding mechanisms in here that go to support and pay for union efforts. That is not infrastructure. And to your point, Robin, Joe Manchin will be the man of the hour when it comes to this going to vote, because he stood up against the minimum wage increase in the last spending bill, and that was taken out. And he has concerns with a lot of the funding in this specific bill, and specifically the raising of the corporate income tax rate. And if he goes against this, this is dead in the water.
Okay, Bill, Alice, just quick response.
Robin, if I may. Yeah. I think Alice just makes my point that both sides ought to sit down and be talking about these issues. I could make a strong argument that home health care for our ailing parents and grandparents and soon us is an important part of infrastructure. Maybe I lose that argument, but at least it should be debated. That's what the legislative process is all about. With Joe Manchin, he wants to go to 28% instead of 25% instead of 28. Mm-hmm. Fine. Then Joe Manchin makes his point. If he gets enough votes, he wins. My point is, you have to be talking. And for Republican Party to say no, 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 then Democrats have no alternative other than reconciliation, other than doing nothing. And that is unacceptable.
Okay, let's move on to, you mentioned corporations, and they're in the middle of another story. And by the way, before we do move on, I just want to say, I think the parliamentarian, this rulemaker, is a she, which is noting just because that's kind of new and rare.
But the corporations,
they're reacting to Georgia's new voter laws, which Republican lawmakers claim are to calm fears that the election was stolen. Democrats are saying, nice try, you make up a lie that an election was stolen, and then pass laws, they say, to restrict Democrats from voting. Yesterday, Biden was asked if the Masters golf tournament should move out of Atlanta. Let's listen.
I think it's a very tough decision for a corporation to make or group to make. But I respect them when they make that judgment, and I support whatever judgment they make.
Now, Masters is different from other sports like the All-Star Game. You know, the Masters, they live. You know, the golf tournament lives in Georgia. But Alice, you tweeted out something about you were surprised at that. Why? What would you advise the Masters to do?
I would advise the Masters to continue putting on the greatest golf tournament that there is in the country, in the world. And it is an important legacy for Augusta, Georgia, and for the state of Georgia, and for golf. And it has absolutely nothing to do with this. And I think it's really important for corporations to realize if they're going to get into politics, they need to do so with the facts and not misinformation. And it's critical that people realize, in this case, we have MLB pulling out of Atlanta for the All-Star Game. Delta supported it, as well as Coca-Cola. But people need to realize, just because Delta is ready when the mob is and Coke is now woke, it does not mean they're right. Delta CEO initially supported this election effort for the election integrity and codifying certain voting procedures, as well as the absentee ballot. And he was pressured by failed gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams to pull the All-Star Game out and to not support this measure. And now he's saying that this election legislation does not support Delta's values. I think that is hypocritical, and it means that this decision is not based on fact.
Okay, let's bring Bill in. Yep.
Robin, this whole response and this whole approach of Republicans to this issue is dripping with hypocrisy. We remember Citizens United. Republicans considered their greatest achievement getting the Supreme Court to rule that corporations are people. Remember that phrase, right? Mm-hmm. And they can be involved in politics. Mitch McConnell said, this is great. Corporations should be involved in politics. And corporations did, and they gave hundreds of millions of dollars, mostly to Republican PACs and Republican candidates, and Republicans loved it. And now that corporations, now that they're involved in politics, want to express an opinion, especially about something as fundamental as the right to vote, Mitch McConnell is saying, you're going to face dire consequences if you dare get involved in
politics.
Well,
funny you should mention. Oh, yeah. Funny you should mention. We have Mitch McConnell. Let's listen. Let's just listen. Let's listen to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
That's fine. It's legal. It's appropriate. I support that. I'm talking about taking a position on a highly incendiary issue like this And punishing a community or a state because you don't like a particular law they passed, I just think it's stupid.
And at the top, he was saying it's appropriate to make political donations, but it's stupid for corporations to get involved. And Bill, as you just outlined, is something he did.
Now, if I can finish my point. So the plan, the Republican position today is we'll take your money, but shut up otherwise. Don't express any opinion, even on something as basic as the right to vote.
The issue is making these decisions based on fact versus fiction. And the decision to pull out based on what they saw as a law that was voter suppression as opposed to election integrity was completely misguided. And the concern here is this is not Las Vegas. And what's happening now in Atlanta does not stay in Atlanta. And the mob outrage culture will continue to do so. And it's really unfortunate.
Robin, okay, wish we had time for anybody. I wish we had time to explain why making it a crime to give somebody standing in line to vote a drink of water or a sandwich or a slice of pizza, why that has anything to do with an election integrity. It is all racist voter suppression.
Well, and of course, we do have a little bit of time here, just a few seconds. But those who passed the law said it was electioneering on the lines of voters. And others have said you've manipulated it so that there are lines and lines and lines and hours for certain communities to wait. And so they need water.
Alice. People can get water.
That's Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist. Bill Press. Okay, a little more. Bill Press, the Democratic strategist. Thank you both, as always.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Alice.
Thanks, Robin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
It's been a week since Alexei Navalny, President Putin's fiercest critic, started a hunger strike in a Russian penal colony. In the last year, he also survived a poisoning that doctors in Germany said was a Soviet-era nerve agent. Putin denies state involvement. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is on Skype from Moscow. And Sarah, Navalny started this hunger strike because he said he wasn't getting proper medical treatment for back and leg pains. What do we know about how he's doing?
Well, we know that since he complained about problems with his back and his legs, he's also developed a temperature and a bad cough, and he's been admitted to the medical unit. We were actually outside the prison yesterday, and there were a group of doctors allied with Mr. Navalny trying to intercede on Mr. Navalny's behalf and to call for proper medical help to be given to him, because he has really a sort of a growing list of increasingly serious complaints. And I think particularly he's concerned about those pains in his back. He's talked about shooting pains going down his legs. And in fact, he was taken by the hospital some time ago. He was taken for a scan in a local hospital and has been diagnosed with two slipped discs and some arthritis in his spine. So he is getting some medical care. But the problem is that, as you mentioned, this is a man, a political opponent of the Kremlin, who says and who was poisoned in August last year with a military grade nerve agent, something that he blames directly on the Kremlin. And so he doesn't trust prison doctors. He wants somebody independent to come and see him, to diagnose him and to get him help.
Yeah, understandable. Well, some of his supporters were detained yesterday outside this penal colony, which, by the way, is about 50 miles east of Moscow and sounds like a pretty dark ages place. But what happened yesterday?
The doctors were allowed to gather for a while, but eventually the police basically lost patience and they rolled in the police buses and they started bundling people into them, including Anastasia Vasilieva, who is Mr. Navalny's personal doctor, she was detained for some time, and a couple of people were held overnight as well. So a fairly sort of standard Russian reaction to what they were calling an unauthorized gathering.
Yeah. Well, Navalny was taken into custody and jailed after he returned from Germany, where he'd been recovering from that poisoning. He was jailed for violating the terms of his probation on an earlier embezzlement conviction, which his supporters think was trumped up. But it does seem, I mean, that President Putin is targeting him. I mean, just your sense, is there fear that he really is a political threat?
Well, I don't think there's any real doubt that his imprisonment and his treatment generally is political. I mean, he is an active campaigner against corruption. He's released all sorts of videos incriminating senior figures within the presidential administration and very senior members of the Russian elite here. So he is a thorn in the side of Mr. Putin personally, and many people will tell you that this is revenge, essentially political persecution. Now, on the other hand, you've got a big campaign from state media to discredit Mr. Navalny. They had leaked videos from inside the prison dating back to the last week of March, which appeared to show Mr. Navalny walking around the prison colony, apparently not in too much pain, or at least physically moving anyway. And they were saying that, look, this is showing that he is simply attention seeking, that he's lying about his health, that this is all a big sort of political ploy by Mr. Navalny.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Engineers in Florida have secured a leaking wastewater reservoir that had threatened to send a wall of water cascading through a neighborhood south of Tampa. For days, crews had been draining that water. It had been left over from decades of fertilizer production. Now, nearby residents are returning to their evacuated homes, but the problem isn't over yet. Zach Sampson is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Zach, welcome.
Hey, how are you? Thanks, Peter.
Doing well, thanks. When we spoke with a scientist earlier this week there in Tampa, there was still this threat of catastrophic flooding. How have engineers been able to shore up that reservoir since then?
Yeah, well, there have been new teams that have come down, particularly from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And one thing that they've been doing all week has been draining water from this pond pretty rapidly. And as of late Tuesday, they said that the risk of a sort of immediate catastrophic flood has dropped significantly. And so they have closed the evacuation orders and allowed people to move back to their homes.
Well, that water they've been pumping out, it's a lot. It's like 30 million gallons of water every day to relieve the pressure on the banks of the reservoir. But now what? Because that water is rich with phosphorus. And if I understand this correctly, it's making its way into Tampa Bay, and that could have a disastrous effect on the ecosystem. How are they going to clean that up?
Yeah, good question. And I think to some extent that remains to be seen. But the water is high in nutrients. And the one that is particularly concerning to sort of the clean water advocates who have been doing work here in Tampa Bay on restoration and protection, you know, what they say essentially is that this wastewater is just like on land with nitrogen, it's going to be a fertilizer. And the potential then is that it provides fuel for harmful algal blooms. That's things like red tide, and other algae that will come in and can potentially hurt the ecosystem and potentially down the line lead to lowering oxygen levels in the water, which then create fish kills.
Yeah. What about this idea of putting the remaining water in tanker trucks and shipping it to other states? Is that going to happen?
I'm not sure if that's going to happen yet. There have already been, from what we've been told, some tanker trucks from within Florida that have taken it offsite. There was some talk from Manatee County official yesterday of a potential out-of-state contractor coming in with storage tanks to hold potentially tens more than 100 million gallons on site, which would theoretically keep it out of the bay, at least for now.
Longer term, though, what do you think is going to happen with this reservoir? And for that matter, for reservoirs that are just like it all across the state of Florida?
Yeah, good question. I think there's a lot of attention on Piney Point right now, and public officials are going to try to harness that focus on the immediate crisis to try to get a long-term closure to the wastewater ponds and gypsum stacks here at Piney Point. What that looks like right now is Manatee County officials have moved forward as of yesterday with a plan to build potentially a deep well to inject some of the wastewater after treatment underground. And where that goes from here remains to be seen, but they're moving forward on that front, at least for this site.
It's a good news, bad news situation there in Tampa. Zach Sampson, reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you are a parent with school-age kids in this pandemic, you might feel like homework is just one more thing that's causing your family stress. Should kids even have homework anymore? Alan Yu at WHYY's The Pulse has been wondering the same thing.
Dawn Siff is a mother of two in New York. Her kids are 5 and 10. And like many working parents, she now has a lot to do at home.
Everyone is home, and I have to keep my children, like, on their Zooms. And also, everyone is hungry all the time. And also, the house is dirty all the time. And I just never really bargained for parenting this hard for this much time.
And so she was a little taken aback when her 5-year-old's teacher messaged her to say her daughter wasn't doing her homework.
And I just thought, oh my God, homework for a kindergartner in the middle of a pandemic. Like, can't we all just show each other a little bit of grace? Like, surely this is not necessary right now.
Sif is in a group chat with friends who are also mothers, who were just as frustrated at being shamed for not making their children do homework. Many teachers want to ease the stress for students and families. Some cut back on homework during the pandemic. And this is leading parents, teachers, and students to rethink homework, something that used to be taken for granted as just part of school. Of course, homework can be good. Students can practice skills, apply them to real-world situations, or prepare for class the next day. But many years ago, Marion Dingle questioned whether homework really accomplished those things. She is an elementary educator in Georgia, and she has been teaching for over 20 years. She's also a mom of two.
What is this notion of homework that we have? Why is it that we believe that children don't learn on their own without being assigned a certain, you know, particular thing that they have to do that they may or may not be interested in?
If a student has to do homework that they consider to be dull, busy work, it is not very effective. As an example, Dingle points to a reading log. A student has to read a certain amount outside of school, write this down in a log, and get a parent to sign it. And this reminded her of her own piano lessons as a child. She also had to log how much she practiced and get her mother to sign it.
During those times where I was doing a piece that I hated, it was like pulling teeth. And my mother would just get sick of me begging her to sign it, and she would just sign it. And of course, it was meaningless.
She realized teachers can assign homework and figure out if a student did a specific task, but it does not really show that their students have learned anything. And so,
I haven't assigned homework in probably over a decade.
Indiana University sociologist Jessica Calarco studied a school district and recently published findings on elementary and middle school math homework. She interviewed a mother who passed GED-level math and struggled to help her son with his 5th-grade math homework.
I mean, she was on the verge of tears talking to me about how difficult helping her son with math homework was for her. She's someone who the education system repeatedly failed throughout her own educational history, and to then have to be expected to provide support for her son with math and to feel just completely debilitated in that process, to feel like she was powerless to provide her son with the help that he needed to be able to be successful himself.
Teachers started to treat this student differently. They saw him as a kid who did not do his work, and that became a vicious cycle.
He was not getting a lot of support at home because his mom couldn't provide him with support at home. And the teachers, especially by middle school, really just wrote him off and said, like, this kid is just, we're just not going to help him because he's not putting in the effort to do it. And just ignoring the challenges that he had faced from a very early age in getting the support that he needed to be successful in school.
Calarco's team found that homework, especially in early grades, had as much to do with the resources and time that a student's family has to support them as it does with the student's actual ability. So judging students based on homework can reinforce existing inequality and class differences. After decades of research, scientists agreed on how much homework is just right. It boils down to a 10-minute rule.
Take a student's grade and you multiply it by 10, and that's the number of minutes each night a student should be doing.
Harris Cooper came up with the rule. He's Emeritus Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. The basic idea is older kids can benefit from more homework, but it should never be excessive.
Adding more homework after the 10 minutes doesn't improve achievement.
However, this rule does not fix everything.
It's really tempting to think that if we can just find the answers to what makes a good teacher, and we can just get all the teachers to do it, then all our problems will be solved.
Grace Chen is a graduate student of education at Vanderbilt University. She studies math teachers, and she used to be one herself. She says many teachers know homework is not always fair. Some have changed their policies.
But I also know teachers who feel sort of trapped and don't really know what to do because for so long, the idea of school in this country is associated with doing homework.
Chen says teachers and schools can certainly think carefully about homework and avoid harm to students. But that only begins to address the larger problems of inequality in U.S. society, which no homework rule can solve. For Here and Now, I'm Alan Yu.
So what's Tyler Andrews been up to? Last time we spoke with the 30-year-old, he'd clocked the fastest known running time on the 40-mile Salkantay Inca Trail through the Andes. Most hikers take 4 days. He took 6 hours. Among his world records, one for the fastest treadmill marathon. Always something with that, Tyler. And now he's trying to beat the fastest known times, or FKTs, on 10 of South America's most challenging peaks, including Ecuador's over 19,000-foot Cotopaxi volcano and the world's tallest volcano, Chile's Ojos del Salado. We have incredible pictures at herenow.org, but it's all while raising funds for his Chosky Foundation, his charity to fund running programs in disadvantaged communities. Tyler joins us now from Ecuador. What are you attempting to do on these peaks?
The term FKT that you mentioned, fastest known time, is kind of a little subculture in running and trail running, mountain running especially, that's kind of sprung up a lot during COVID. You just go out and run on a specific route and there's no organized race, there's no finish line, there's nothing like that. It's kind of just you against, you know, the history books. And I think for obvious reasons, that's been really popular during the pandemic because you don't need to have 40,000 people running a marathon at the same time. You can have people going out and doing these things by themselves.
Well, you pick these just amazing peaks because you say you need goals that scare you. As we said, you got the fastest known time on the Ojos del Salado in Chile. But just a couple weeks later, you came up a little short on Tungurahua, a volcano in Ecuador.
Yep.
How tough was that? Some would have quit right there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things I learned is that one of the big differences between running on the track or a road marathon even versus running up a 15 or 20,000 foot mountain is that the mountains really have a big input into whether your day is going to go well or not. When we did the Ojos del Salado record, it was an absolutely perfect day. Conditions on the mountain were really good. It was like, okay, the mountain is saying yes, it's granting us safe passage. And we brought the record down from 21 hours to 9 hours. And then Tungurahua was pouring rain. It was really muddy. I think I was probably within maybe 20 minutes of the summit and just started hearing thunder. And you're on a really exposed ridge at that point. And that's where I've learned to listen to that fear and know when it's fear that's exciting and motivating and when it's fear that is a warning sign of actual danger. And being up at 19,000 feet or 18,000 feet on an exposed mountaintop in a thunderstorm, to me, that's too much danger for me to tolerate. And so that's where it's like, okay, it's not worth it today. We're going to go back down.
Yeah, you'd have to have that discipline to know when the mountain is saying no and not take it personally, because then, yes, you do go on to Cotopaxi, held by the best big mountain speed climber in the world. He's got the records for Kilimanjaro and Denali. I mean, it must be a thrill, or is it too, like, just gasping for air to be a thrill? I mean, what's it like when you're running up there?
The shorter routes like Cotopaxi, I'm just pushing as hard as I can, and I'm redlining, and I'm just trying to stay on the right side of that line. And there was this moment where I kind of got to this decision point where I was high up on the mountain and it was kind of a sketchy piece. There was a crevasse crossing and I was by myself and I was not on a rope team, which I had never done before. And I kind of had this moment where I actually stopped and like looked at the route and was like, okay, is this a level of risk that I'm willing to tolerate? And again, going back to that idea of fear and kind of knowing when to listen to fear and knowing when to push through fear, that was a time where my rational brain was able to take a second and say, okay, this is okay. I can deal with this. This is risk that I'm willing to tolerate. The longer routes like Ojos, where it's 9.5 hours and, you know, you're starting out in the middle of the night and you're finishing in the midday, there are those moments of like real serenity, you know, running through the darkness by yourself and it's completely silent. And those are really, really special, beautiful moments that you don't get very often to take a step back from the strain of what you're actually doing and say, this is unbelievable that I'm even here, let alone that I'm, you know, trying to do something that, you know, maybe no one's ever done before.
We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org, but your description of, you know, coming to like crevasses is making my palms sweat. Well, so you founded this Chatsky Foundation. By the way, Chatskys were messengers of the Inca Empire?
Exactly, yeah. So the Chatskys were the original ultra trail runners. The Incans had this incredible network of trails that traversed this extremely rugged terrain over thousands of miles. And they essentially had a network of relay runners where they could send a message out from one point with a bunch of relay runners running in different directions, and they'd pass the message on to the next person, and then they'd pass it on to the next person. Chatskys really held the whole empire together in terms of communication.
Do you ever feel like an Incan messenger, you know, wings appearing on your heels?
I don't want to like dive too much into the cultural appropriation of that. Like, I definitely respect the Chatskys, and like, I have lots of friends who are athletes who have indigenous ancestors here in South America. And mostly, like, when I run with those guys in the mountains, they remind me of like, who is the real Chatsky here? You know, like, they kick my butt up and down these mountains. But, you know, it's something that I aspire to and I'm inspired by.
Tyler Andrews, running some of the tallest peaks in South America in pursuit of the world's fastest known times on each of them. Tyler, stay safe. Keep us posted.
Thank you so much.
I'm looking at the pictures at hearnow.org. Wacky guy. You got to see them. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.